So I'm Kendrick, and I'm going to be teaching cosmology for the next 3 weeks. So just a few logistical notes before I start the first lecture. First, there's no textbook, but I do post my lecture notes on the wiki usually every couple of days. So for example, I should be able to post the notes for this lecture immediately after the class. I would say that one of the reasons why I don't use a textbook is that I like to emphasize data analysis a little more than most of the textbooks do. I think cosmologists include theoretical physicists, people who are more like statisticians, and people who are more like software engineers. I personally kind of like all three, and one of the fun things about cosmology is being able to do all three of those things at once. But I'm more, I would say, on the data analysis and software side. I started studying cosmology assuming that I would be more of a theorist, and then sort of gravitated over to the data analysis side of the subject. And I think that's because I personally think it's a little more exciting. This is just my perspective, but I think in cosmology, the theory is sort of ahead of the data in the sense that we have lots of models and the theorists are mostly waiting for the experiments to catch up and constrain things better. And it was sort of hard for me to see, as a student when I was studying the subject, how I was going to write a paper every few months improving the theory. Whereas the data analysis side of the subject is super fast moving. It's really sort of transforms itself every 5 years. And that process is not just a matter of doing the same analysis procedure to more sensitive experiments. There's a lot of conceptual work that has to be done to invent new statistics and do things like figure out what new physics the next generation of experiments can constrain. So last year, I tried sort of doing a mix of early universe physics and data analysis, essentially splitting the class in half. And I ended up having mixed feelings about this. The Sci courses are really short, and it doesn't really make sense to split a class that's already only 3 weeks in half. So this year, I decided, I also got really good course feedback on the data analysis part. The students seemed to enjoy the change of pace and spending a few weeks studying something a little different. So this year, I'm going to try making the class more data analysis focused. So let's say the title can be Data Oriented Cosmology. I sometimes call myself a data oriented cosmologist. So I'm going to try to do a data analysis centric class. Of course, I will talk about physics as well, since that's the reason that we're doing all the data analysis in the first place. In particular, I am going to assign computer problems. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the problems where the answer to the problem is a computer program. So I want to talk a little bit about the logistics of that. First off, does everyone here have a personal laptop that they can write code on? Well, let's say hands up if you don't. Okay, great. If for some reason you need a loaner laptop from IT, they do have them. So just let me know if that would be useful, and I'm sure we can work it out. You can feel free to use whatever programming language you want. I think for small programs, the choice of programming language is usually not very important. And of course, these are going to be problem sets where you're not building large software systems. You're just doing standalone, relatively short programs. So some choices that you might consider. I think a lot of people with a physics background are familiar with Mathematica. So if you're already familiar with that, that might be that is probably the path of least resistance. The programming language that I would recommend as having the greatest long-term usefulness if you plan to do data analysis work is Python. So if you already have familiarity with this, that's a great choice. And if you don't, but you kind of enjoy software and you are interested in learning Python, then I think it would be a great use of your time to try to learn it for the class and do the problems in Python. I think that's a reasonable thing to try to do. When you use Python, there's version 2 of the language and version 3 of the language. And most people have recently switched to Python 3. I'm still a caveman, and I use Python 2. So if you want to, I mentioned this because I'm going to post on the wiki, probably not today, but tomorrow before the tutorial, some tutorial references and a little Python cookbook that will be helpful to follow for the first problem set. And that will be in Python 2. If you want to be one of the cool kids, not a caveman like me, you might try using Python 3. And finally, there's Julia, which is like a new language that I personally haven't tried yet. But a lot of people seem to really like it. It's oriented toward numerical programming. So you might be familiar with this if you took earlier this year the computational physics class taught by Eric Schneider here at PI. I actually just can't give a recommendation either way because I've never tried it. But if you're already familiar with it, then that would probably be a good choice. So it's kind of an experiment giving the computer problems. And in particular, it's my expectation that the first couple of tutorials will largely be a forum for people who are kind of new at programming to ask questions and get up to speed with using one of these languages and tackling the problems. And if you really, it's kind of an experiment, so if you really hate it or you're struggling to get going with it, then you should view that as a sign that the experiment needs improvement, and you can let me know and we'll find a solution. Speaking of the tutorials, so I personally don't like splitting up problems between problem sets and tutorials. So I'm just gonna assign three long problem sets. Well, not too long. You can use the, and the tutorials can kind of just be like an open, optional venue for getting guidance with the problems if it's helpful. So just feel free to drop by the tutorial sessions, which are on Tuesday and Friday. From 2 to 3:30. Except for this week when the Friday one is on Thursday, because Friday is a holiday. I'm going to try to run the tutorials myself, because I can, which I haven't done in the past, just because I found in the past there's not much interaction between the students and me. And so it's kind of hard for me to tell like how I'm doing, whether I'm like lecturing too fast or too slow or what things could use improvement. So we'll see how it goes. There's definitely a few tutorials where I have conflicting meetings, at least one tutorial where I have a conflicting meeting and won't be able to make it, but I'm gonna try to be there myself. One final detail on the problem sets is that I'm gonna have them due on Wednesday before class. And that's so on Wednesday morning, at Wednesday at the beginning of class, I can talk about the problem sets, and sometimes there are aspects of the solution that I like to talk about. That means in particular, I can't give, like, since I'm going to talk about them, I can't really give an extension on the problem sets, but that's okay because it's a pass-fail class anyway, so just hand in whatever you've got and it's fine. Okay. So today I'm just going to review the expanding universe, which is all material that you've probably seen before, but I kind of like reviewing for the first lecture or two, because I like to give a self-contained class. And also, each lecturer kind of has their own like different way of thinking about things. Let's start with the metric. The FRW metric has this form, where the function a of t is the scale factor. It's just a function of time which describes how the universe expands. This is logically out of order, since I'll talk in a few minutes about how this is computed. But it may just be helpful to know in advance that a of t looks qualitatively like this. For the first 10 to the 5 years after the Big Bang, the universe is in a period of radiation domination. Its stress energy is dominated by relativistic particles. And the scale factor grows as t to the 1/2. There's then a long period of matter domination, where the stress energy is dominated by non-relativistic particles, and the expansion speeds up a bit to, this is a challenge to my, I don't think on the blackboard you can really convey the difference visually between t to the 1/2 and t to the 2/3, but the universe grows parametrically a little faster. Matter domination is just cosmologist radiation domination and matter domination are just cosmologists speak for saying that the stress energy is dominated by relativistic and non-relativistic particles. And then after 10 billion years, the universe becomes cosmological constant dominated, meaning that the expansion rate switches over from being a power of t to an exponential e to the ht, where the Hubble rate h is roughly constant in time. And we're here at 14 billion years. And by definition, the scale factor is 1 today and 0 at the Big Bang. Now, in writing down this metric, I've assumed that the spatial curvature is 0. Of course, the Fourier curvature is allowing non-zero curvature would make all of the equations significantly more complicated. And with modern data, we know that the curvature is pretty small. Its contribution to the expansion has to be of order 1% or less. So curvature used to kind of be a central thing that was included by assumption. But nowadays, I think it makes more sense to view it as sort of a niche cosmological parameter, similar to other things like allowing the equation of state of the dark energy to be different from minus 1 and not include curvature by default when talking about the FRW metric. Another approximation that I'm making in writing this down is that the universe is spatially uniform. Of course, the real universe is not. The matter is distributed non-uniformly in galaxies and dark matter halos, et cetera. If the universe is viewed at sufficiently coarse resolution or smooth on large scales, then spatial uniformity is a good approximation. And so this is just a zeroth order. This spatially uniform approximation is just a zeroth order background that will eventually perturb by adding inhomogeneous perturbations. But we'll just talk about the background for now. So the first thing I want to talk about in relation to the FRW metric is what its symmetries are. Who wants to? I like to pester the class with questions. So who wants to state some symmetries of the FRW metric?
Translation invariance.
Sorry?
Translation invariance.
Great. So translations for three symmetries. Anything else?
Rotations?
Yeah. Rotations are another three independent symmetries. Anything else? What about time translations? I'll interpret the silence as no, which is the right answer. For a general A of t, time translations are not considered a symmetry of the FRW metric, since if I define a primed time by shifting t by a constant, then the metric that I would get is another FRW metric where the scale factor has just been shifted over by a constant. And it's only counted as a symmetry if the metric is exactly preserved under the operation. So time translation generically is not a symmetry of the FRW metric. And that's actually like kind of a profound statement. The invariance under translations and rotations mean that the universe doesn't have a preferred location or a preferred orientation. But the non-invariance under time translations does mean that the universe, we live at a preferred point in the universe's history. You know, as you can see from the plot, there are preferred times. The statement that the expansion history is not invariant under time translation just means that there's no self-similarity and there are preferred times in the universe's evolution, like the time when it switches from radiation to matter domination. Famously, Einstein didn't like this property of the FRW metric and wanted to make the universe static, and sort of did this by doctoring things up by introducing a negative cosmological constant so that they would cancel the effect on the expansion from the matter. And eventually viewed the historically viewed this as his greatest mistake, not recognizing that general relativity predicted an expanding universe with preferred points in the history. Finally, what about boosts or boost-like symmetries? That's right. And I don't think that statement is obvious, but I will just say that if you try to construct boost-like symmetries, you know, such as you have for Minkowski, then what you'll find is that you get time-space terms in the metric. You don't even preserve the FRW form of the metric. And that's a really interesting statement, too. It means that the universe, the FRW expanding universe, has a preferred rest frame. And so you can see that formally by playing with the metric and trying to construct boost-like symmetries. But to convince you that that's a real observational fact, let me describe an experiment that you can do to measure the rest frame of the universe. So the first step is get a few $1 million together and build a CMB telescope. And once you've just taken care of that trivial thing, you'll find that the cosmic microwave background to zeroth order is uniform on the sky. It's 2.726 Kelvin in every direction. But if you measure it sensitively, you can start to see the small anisotropy. And the largest anisotropy in the CMB sky is the dipole. This constant piece is called the monopole. And then if you observe to better and better sensitivity, you'll see the CMB dipole, which is around 3 millikelvin. So the CMB would be 2.729 Kelvin in this direction and 2.723 Kelvin in this direction. Now, if you've seen like visually a map of the CMB sky, if you've seen it plotted, then you may not know that the dipole is there because it's usually subtracted off. And what's shown instead is the cosmological anisotropy underneath the dipole, which is even smaller by about 100 microK. But if you just plot the CMB anisotropy without subtracting the dipole by hand, then the dipole is much larger than the cosmological anisotropy. And in fact, it's the only thing you can really see in the map. So this dipole arises, you can think of it as just Doppler shifting the CMB, because we're moving in the CMB rest frame in this direction at 10 to the minus 3 C. We see the CMB photons blue shifted by 1 part in 10 to the 3 in this direction and red shifted from the other direction. So the CMB dipole is kind of like a cosmic speedometer that tells you your velocity relative to an absolute rest frame, the CMB rest frame. And in fact, the Earth's motion around the sun is, the Earth's velocity around the sun is about 10 to the minus 4 C. So the CMB dipole changes by 10% between summer and winter. So just for fun, just as an aside, here's a physics trivia question. Are there special cases of the FRW metric with more symmetry?
A equals to 1.
Yeah, so Minkowski. A equals 1. Has time translations and boosts. For a total of 10 symmetries. There's another interesting special case of the FRW metric with the same number of symmetries, 10. Does anyone know what it happens to be?
It's another constant.
Oh, yeah, so yeah, I suppose A equals constant. I'm also going to count that as Minkowski, since you could always just rescale the spatial coordinates by a constant to bring this to A equals 1. That's right. So now, when a string theorist says de Sitter, they mean something slightly different from what a blue-collar cosmologist means when they say de Sitter. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So for what a cosmologist would mean by de Sitter is an FRW background where the scale factor is exponentially increasing, or equivalently h is constant, or equivalently h dot equals 0. And de Sitter has as much symmetry as Minkowski. It has 10 independent symmetries. But that is highly non-obvious. And in fact, the symmetries are really non-trivial to construct if you just stare at an FRW metric with exponentially increasing scale factor. A picture which explains this high symmetry is as follows. What a string theorist would mean by de Sitter is the global de Sitter spacetime, which you studied is a space of constant curvature that you studied in the first cosmology class. Say it's the formula for it isn't really important, but it's can be constructed as a four-dimensional hyperboloid sitting in a five-dimensional Minkowski space. And it has a large symmetry group, or O4, 1 with 10 symmetries, the same size symmetry group as Minkowski space. So this is a highly symmetric description, which makes the large symmetry group kind of manifest. Now it turns out, and this is like super non-obvious, that if I take half of the de Sitter space, if I consider the subset of the de Sitter space that satisfies an inequality like this, that under a change of coordinates, it can be written to look like a FRW spacetime with exponentially increasing scale factor. So that's the reason why this. But the symmetries, the large symmetries, are obscured in the FRW coordinate system. I don't really mention this for any particular reason, except that these spaces of constant curvature appear in many different areas of theoretical physics, and so they're just sort of generally useful to know about. Okay. So the FRW spacetime can be explained physically as follows. The universe has a global rest frame. Observers whose velocity is zero, in the global rest frame are called co-moving observers. They're at rest in FRW coordinates. There's a global time coordinate t defined on the spacetime, which is just the value of t at an event in spacetime is just the time that a co-moving observer would measure on a clock if they carried it from the Big Bang to the event. There are global coordinates x on the spacetime, which are co-moving distances. And those are the co-moving distance between two events, delta x. It's just the distance between the events that would be measured by two co-moving observers if they wait until today to make the measurement. And what the expanding universe means is that the physical distance between two events at the same time, the physical distance between two simultaneous events, is just a of t times the coordinate distance between the events. So if I measure the distance between two events when the scale at an earlier point in the universe's history where the scale factor is the third, say, then I would find that the universe has expanded by a factor of 3 since then. Next, I want to talk about geodesics in the FRW spacetime. Following like this standard logical ordering in GR, I'll talk about the metric first, then Christoffel symbols in geodesics, then curvature in Einstein's equations. One more definition I forgot to say. The Hubble rate. The Hubble expansion rate. It's just the time derivative of log t, or the fractional expansion rate per unit time. So h has units of inverse time, and it's like the basic cosmological scale. For example, the age of the universe today, the proper time elapsed since the Big Bang, is an order one number times h inverse. So geodesics. So let me remind you that generally speaking in GR, a geodesic x mu of lambda satisfies the geodesic equation. So we just want to specialize this to the FRW metric. The parameter lambda here is a so-called affine parameter for the geodesic, which for the case of a time-like geodesic can be chosen to be proper time along the world line of the geodesic. The affine parameter is often written tau, but I'm going to reserve tau for a different thing called conformal time. So if we want to specialize the geodesic equation to an FRW spacetime, then we need to calculate Christoffel symbols. And by a standard GR calculation that I won't write out in detail, you can calculate the Christoffel symbols from the components of the metric. For the FRW spacetime, you get the following result. The only non-zero Christoffel symbols are these. Other Christoffel symbols, such as three zeros or three spatial indices, vanish. So in principle, this tells you everything you know about geodesics. You know the Christoffel symbols. You can integrate the geodesic equation. But here's one little identity, which is really useful, which is that you can show in the geodesic equation in that form of the Christoffel symbols. That the FRW 3 momentum let me define let me use the notation p mu for the first derivative of the geodesic. That the spatial part of the FRW 4 momentum is proportional to 1 over a squared. And this sort of gives a simple characterization of FRW geodesics without needing to go back to the geodesic equation. This is true for either a time-like or a null geodesic. Now, of course, it follows that if I write the momentum with an upper index, and of course, if I wrote the momentum with a lower index, then it would be constant. When I lower spatial indices with the FRW metric, I get a factor of a squared. What about the physical momentum, or the momentum that a real particle detector positioned along the world line that just makes local measurements and doesn't know about the expansion history of the universe. How does the physical momentum relate to the FRW momentum? So it turns out that the physical momentum is equal to A times the upper index P, or A inverse times the lower index P. I mentioned this because in cosmology textbooks, often factors of A like this are just sort of produced out of nowhere, leaving the reader to fill in the little derivation. And the way the little derivation works in this case is that if you want to see how the physical momentum is related to the FRW momentum, you might start by saying that the physical momentum is m. Let's just consider. I'll just consider the case of a of a time-like geodesic with non-zero rest mass. Is m zero times the rest mass times the derivative of the physical distance with respect to the particle's proper time. By definition, the FRW through momentum with a raised index would be m0 times the coordinate, the derivative of the coordinate distance with respect to the affine parameter or proper time. So now you can see where the factor of A appears. This is just A. Physical distances are A times coordinate distances. So this is A times the FRW for momentum with a raised index. So the physical momentum redshifts is 1 over A, putting all of this together. And that's just a simple way of thinking about how geodesics evolve in an FRW spacetime. For a massive particle, the momentum is the rest mass times v over its square root of 1 minus v squared, where v is the physical velocity between 0 and 1. This quantity would just redshift as 1 over a, which means that the velocity eventually goes to 0 and the particle becomes co-moving. This phenomenon is sometimes called Hubble drag, that if I turn a massive particle loose in an FRW spacetime with whatever initial velocity I want, it'll eventually come to rest in the FRW rest ring. For a null geodesic, of course, the physical momentum is just the energy or the frequency. Which means that the frequency of a photon redshifts as 1 over a, which is, of course, how the expansion of the universe is observed. If I observe a galaxy whose spectrum has a spectral line at some known rest frequency, nu naught, and I observe the galaxy at a cosmological distance so that I'm observing the photon at a equals 1, and it was originally emitted at scale factor A0, then I'll observe the spectral line redshifted to a lower frequency A0, U0. Now I want to talk about, maybe I'll switch. This board, I think it's hidden behind the podium, so I'm going to use this side. So now I'll talk about curvature in Einstein's equations. Generally speaking, in GR, Einstein's equations relate derivatives of the metric to the stress energy tensor. So if we specialize this equation to FRW, we'll get Friedmann's equation. Just to write that out, for the FRW metric, you can calculate the Ricci tensor from the Christoffel symbols in the metric. And you get the following. And plugging this Ricci tensor into Einstein's equation, you get two equations. I forgot to write the stress energy tensor for FRW. Let me come back to this. So the FRW stress energy tensor has to have the following form. This follows because the stress energy tensor has to have the same symmetries as the FRW metric, namely translation and rotation symmetries. So the rotation symmetry means that I can't have off-diagonal time-space terms or off-diagonal space-space terms in the metric. And then the translation symmetry implies that the functions that appear have to be functions of time only and can't have dependence on the spatial coordinates. So this functional form follows from symmetry alone. Then I want to identify rho of t with the physical energy density. Where I've included the term physical here just to emphasize that it's energy per physical volume, physical 3 volume, not energy per co-moving 3 volume. So if I add up the energy of all particles and divide by the physical volume, where the energy would be the rest mass for a non-relativistic particle or the zero component of the four momentum for a relativistic particle, then I get rho. And P of t is the physical pressure. That is, if an observer who makes all measurements with physical coordinates and not FRW coordinates puts a membrane in the space-time, or let's say inflates a balloon. And then if we assume that all the particles in the universe, for example, the relativistic photons, just bounce elastically off the surface of the balloon, then the physical pressure is just the physically measured force divided arising from all those collisions divided by the area of the balloon. This identification requires a little argument similar to this one that I did in detail for the geodesic that I won't work out because it's a little bit longer, but you end up getting a factor of, and I want to do sort of a rapid review, but you end up getting a factor of a squared here. I wrote that down. I should have written that down first because rho and p will appear on the right-hand sides of Einstein's equations. So Einstein's equations are as follows. And these equations, of course, are really famous. The first one is sometimes called the Friedmann equation. And the second one is sometimes called Friedmann's second equation. And let me just remind you that in these equations and throughout the entire class, I think, I'm going to be assuming that the spatial curvature k is equal to 0. There's another important equation the continuity equation. Which relates the derivative of the density constrains how the total density of the universe evolves, where W is the equation of state of the universe. And it's defined as the total FRW pressure over the energy density. The continuity equation follows from Friedman's equations. If you differentiate rho, use the first Friedman equation to convert that to a derivative of H, and then use the second equation, you'll derive the continuity equation. A more physical way of thinking about the continuity equation is that, generally speaking, in GR, the stress energy always has to be covariantly conserved. And if I write out this identity specialized to the FRW metric, then I get the continuity equation. I find it most natural. You can derive continuity from these two equations, or another thing that's true is that if you take the first Friedman equation plus the continuity equation, you can derive the second one. So I think it's kind of natural to think of like the equations of motion. I shouldn't have split across the two blackboards, but I think it's kind of natural to think about the equations of motion for an FRW spacetime as being the first Friedman equation that tells you how the scale factor A evolves, relates its first derivative to rho, plus the continuity equation that relates the first derivative of rho to the pressure P. Viewed in that way, it's sort of obvious that these equations of motion do not close, because I don't have any sort of equation of motion or constraint on the quantity P. So in order to get a closed system of equations, I need to close the system. I need to know something about P. Which will depend on like the microphysics or what the stress energy is made out of. So let's look at some examples. The simplest example is a constant W universe. Where I assume that the equation of state W is independent of time. Under that assumption, the continuity equation immediately trivially integrates to show that the density evolves as a to the minus 3 times 1 plus w. And then once rho is known as a function of a, then it's straightforward to integrate Friedman's equation and solve for a as a function of time. But that's a problem on the first problem set, so you'll integrate to get A as an analytic function of time and explore its properties a little bit. So some special cases of a constant W universe are W is 1/3 for a radiation-dominated universe, or full of a universe full of relativistic particles. Zero for a matter-dominated universe where the stress energy is coming from non-relativistic particles. Or minus 1 for a cosmological constant. And these values of W can be interpreted physically once you know that the physical energy density is supposed to evolve as a to the minus 3 times 1 plus W. To start with the case of a matter-dominated universe, this value of W equals zero is what's required to make the energy density proportional to a to the minus 3. And that's true because if the stress energy is coming from non-relativistic particles that get their energy from their rest mass, then as the universe expands, the energy per co-moving volume will be constant in time. And the physical volume is a cubed times the co-moving volume. So we expect the physical energy density to dilute as 1 over a cubed with the expansion of the universe. Similarly, for a radiation-dominated universe, W equals 1/3 is what's needed to make the energy density goes a to the minus 4. And that makes sense because if I have a bath of photons, then compared to the matter-dominated case where things diluted as 1 over a to the minus 3, well, the number density of the photons is still going down as a to the minus 3. But in addition, as we saw before, the photons are redshifting and losing energy as 1 over a. So there's an extra factor of 1 over a relative to the matter-dominated case. And finally, W equals minus 1 is what's needed to make the energy density go as a to the 0 or constant in time. And that's what we mean by a cosmological constant. We're just postulating that there's a contribution to the stress energy, which is independent of time. So if we lived in a constant W universe, that would be a complete description. The lambda CDM model is just a small step up in complexity, where we say that the universe is just, the stress energy is just the sum of a radiation term with W equals 1/3, a matter term with W equals 0, and a cosmological constant with W equals minus 1, which don't interact with each other. So those stress energies just, those energy densities just evolve independently. So let me write the I like big lambda for the cosmological constant expresses an energy density. And the pressure would follow by putting the factors of W in front of each term. So just for clarity, I'll write a coefficient of 0 in front of the matter term. Just as a little bit of notation, generally speaking in cosmology, putting a 0 subscript on a quantity means evaluated today or at scale factor 0. So as the universe evolves, components with a lower value of W eventually dominate. The lambda CDM universe starts out with A very small and radiation dominating. As the universe expands and A increases, there's a period when the matter dominates, and then eventually the cosmological constant dominates. And that gives rise to the shape of this curve with different evolution in the different epochs. Just as an aside here, you know, the continuity equation is satisfied for this stress energy tensor, since it's the sum of contributions which individually satisfy the stress energy. And I just mentioned that because it's generally an important thing to check if you're just writing down a stress energy tensor without varying an action to derive it, that the stress energy tensor is conserved in the sense that its divergence is 0. If this identity weren't satisfied, then your stress energy tensor could not consistently appear on the right-hand side of Einstein's equations. So given this model, you can integrate Friedmann's equation to get the complete expansion history. You just can't do it analytically. You have to do it numerically. Okay. A few more topics. I guess I won't quite finish my FRW review today, but time flies when you're talking about something as beautiful as the FRW metric. A topic that I unfortunately have to talk about is the weird cosmologist parameterization of the expansion history. So from everything that I've said so far, you might think that the natural way, the lambda CDM expansion history has three parameters. And so a natural way to parameterize it would be to give the energy densities, the physical energy densities of the radiation and the matter today and the cosmological constant. In cosmology, it's conventional to use a different parameterization. Where I give a number little h, which is around 0.7, which is specifying the Hubble rate today, or equivalently through Friedmann's equation, the total energy density. And then the fraction of the energy density in these different components. So the notation capital omega I, where I is a species, either radiation matter or a cosmological constant, is just its energy density today divided by the total energy density. So these numbers for our lambda CDM model, omega lambda is around 0.7, about 70% of the energy density today is in the cosmological constant. Omega matter is very close to 0.3, and omega radiation is a small number, around 4 times 10 to the minus 5. The H here is parameterizing the total energy density or equivalently the Hubble parameter today, in the following weird units. So if little h is 0.7, that means that h naught is 70. In these weird units where the kilometers are canceling, the kilometers units of distance are canceling the megaparsecs to give something with units of inverse time. So these weird units are natural if you're thinking about when h naught first appeared in physics, it was viewed as a proportionality constant between the distance to a galaxy and its recessional velocity in kilometers per second. So from that perspective, these units are what you want if you want to multiply the distance to a galaxy in megaparsecs and get a recessional velocity in kilometers per second. Now, the little h, it's conventional in cosmology to incorporate little h into the units. For example, you might see the distance to a galaxy written as something like 30 h inverse megaparsecs. And this made sense historically for the following reason. I think throughout the history of cosmology, it's often been the case that there's some sort of controversy over the correct value of h. So like Hubble's original measurement of h naught was, or little h, was off by a factor of 5, I believe. And there was a very long historical period with two camps of astronomers, that one of which thought that little h was 0.5, and the other thought that little h was around 1, with tiny error bars. It actually happens that that controversy has recently reemerged, where currently the CMB, the modern value is around 0.7. But the CMB gives a value of around 0.67. And other probes, such as supernovae, give a value around 0.73. And the discrepancy here is more than 3 sigma. And it's really not clear what's going on, whether there's something wrong with one of the two measurements. The discrepancy, I think, seems too large to me to be a pure statistical fluke. Whether one of these measurements is underestimating their error somehow, or if it's sort of a sign of new physics, that because these measurements of H are made in very different ways, maybe new physics could show up as an apparent discrepancy in H. Anyway, so just to explain why little h is all over the units, imagine that you're an astronomer back in like 1970 or whatever, and you go out and find a new galaxy at redshift 0.1. If you want to say how publish a distance to the galaxy, then what you would do is you would divide the redshift z by h. And in a world where you have no idea what little h is, it might make sense to put little h into the answer. Then when the rest of the astronomers look at your result, if someone thinks that little h is 1, they can view it as 30 megaparsecs. If they think that little h is 0.5, they can view it as 60 megaparsecs. And eventually, 50 years in the future, when we know that little h is 0.7, we can put in the appropriate value. So it made sense historically to build little h into the units. But it's actually kind of historical baggage at this point. Nowadays, little h is known to the accuracy of a few percent. Most cosmological parameters are known to roughly the same accuracy. There's nothing particularly special about little h. And so this isn't really, putting little h into the units isn't really useful anymore. I mentioned this because it unfortunately is a very frequent source of bugs in computer programs. I think there's a theorem that all bugs in cosmology codes are either missing factors of little h and a result that's off by 0.7, or missing factors of the scale factor A. So you'll see like certain combinations coming up all the time, like h inverse times a distance. Or another thing that you'll see all the time is the combination omega I h squared, where omega is one of these fractional abundances. This combination appears frequently because it's proportional to the total energy density of the species today. The units are just keeping track of which power of h, how many powers of the Hubble parameter appear. So if I want a physical energy density, I have to multiply omega by rho total, which has two powers of h in it, according to Friedman's equation. Anyway, it's a weird historical artifact that you'll eventually get used to if you do cosmology for long enough. Okay, so I have a little bit more to say, maybe 5 minutes more material, but I'll save it for next time.